From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Trump administration announced this week its Protect Life rule will go into effect immediately. It prohibits groups that get federal family planning funds from referring or providing abortion services. Planned Parenthood stands to lose millions and is taking a stand.
The organization in Illinois is refusing those federal funds and relying on emergency doctors to provide care.
Governor Pritzker's decision to cover this funding in whatever way he plans to, which I'm not really sure how that's possible, but it is deeply political.
Today, Mayor Lightfoot announced five possible sites for a Chicago casino, four on the south side, one on the west side. But noticeably absent is any location in the Loop.
The downtown doesn't need an infusion of funds and revenue. So the communities are the ones that need the resources.
It's a fear mentality that the dealers in the state are somehow complicit with gangbangers in Chicago and those who would create havoc somewhere. It puts lawful businesses out of business and isn't going to do a thing to help safety or prevent crime.
I've read the complaint. I haven't studied it. It seems like pretty weak soup to me. I don't know how it impairs anybody's Second Amendment rights. The fact that almost 1,200 gun dealers in the state are seeking certification of their license suggests it will be just as easy to buy a gun after the certifications are in place.
A lawsuit filed over a new law impacting gun dealers. Also, the issue of abortion back in the headlines in Illinois. Is trouble brewing for House Speaker Michael Madigan? We'll find out more about that. And also, could we be getting closer to a location for a Chicago casino? That and more coming up on State Week. We'll talk about it. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. And our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also with us, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House Editor. And joining us from Chicago, Rick Pearson, political reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Also the host of the Sunday Spin on WGN Radio. Rick, it's good to have you on once again.
It's good to be with you.
Well, I'll start this week on this issue of abortion. And Brian, Planned Parenthood of Illinois had already announced it would reject federal money because of some restrictions that the Trump administration had put on. And now Governor Pritzker says Illinois is going to step in with state grants to help backfill other agencies, about 28 agencies that reject the federal grants. Tell us what's going on here and what Governor Pritzker is trying to accomplish.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, if you look at this from a national perspective, politically, President Trump is trying to shore up his conservative base, although it seems to be pretty solid. But he is, you know, moving to impose this what opponents call a gag rule, where you can't get federal funding for certain medical clinics if you either perform abortions or even refer people to abortions. So Planned Parenthood came out quickly and said they were going to reject their federal money so that they can continue to provide the services they think are necessary to women who are their clients. And then Governor Pritzker followed up later in the week and said that the state of Illinois will step up and provide funding to these 28 agencies that get federal grants. It's estimated to be about $2.4 million in funding if this so-called gag rule remains in place for the duration of this budget year. Apparently, Planned Parenthood is not among those agencies, but this is Governor Pritzker pledged that he would be, you know, make Illinois the most progressive state on abortions. That's a paraphrase of what he said on the campaign trail. And he is once again following through on that.
Charlie, is there any political concern there with the governor taking this type of action? Anything that's going to hurt him politically, you think, in this state?
I would think, given the way Illinois has gone historically and particularly in recent years, there's not a whole lot of downside for him because he's already signed legislation that he himself described as making Illinois the most progressive state in the union on abortion. And he can argue, as he has, that this has more to do with health care of women because Planned Parenthood and these other groups do a lot more than just provide abortions or refer people to doctors who will. They provide family planning, contraceptives, testing for pregnancy, testing for sexually transmitted disease, a whole realm of services. And so, yeah, he'll be the ardent right to lifers will find this as another reason to really detest Governor Pritzker. The elements in the Republican base that are very concerned about the abortion issue will not be any more inclined to vote for Pritzker than they are now, which is not at all. The Trump supporters will be displeased, but as we saw in the last election, there are not a whole lot of Trump supporters in the state of Illinois.
And Rick, your thoughts on that, on Governor Pritzker, as was mentioned before, he wants to make Illinois the most progressive state in the nation on abortion. This is another step toward doing that.
Yeah, and I mean, it is something that he campaigned on, and I kind of found it kind of interesting, some of the critique coming from the state Republican Party, which basically assailed, you know, Pritzker for expanding abortion rights, neglecting to mention that it was Republican Governor Bruce Rauner who basically was the sole funding source of the Illinois Republican Party, who signed HB 40, that bill that allowed for state taxpayer money to be used to fund abortions for poor women. So, you know, as Charlie said, you've kind of got the lines are blurred there. Certainly there's still a very strong pro-life element within the Republican Party, what remains of the Republican Party in Illinois. But you also have to look at some of that evolution that I always talk about in the suburban areas that were always so Republican dominant, and how the emergence of, you know, suburban women, moderate on social issues, are really kind of a driving force that has helped, along with changing demographics, to turn those once Republican-dominant suburbs, almost turn them into pockets of Democratic enclaves.
Wasn't part of that, though, Rick, the fact that the Republican Party itself has changed? Because thinking back to when I began as a reporter and several years later, you, in the legislature, there were a lot of what I would call moderate Republicans, men and women, and nowadays you don't find them.
No, that's exactly right. And certainly, you know, there's any number of people that you talk to Jim Edgar, and he says that I'm not sure that I could get elected as a Republican in this climate. And I mean, it is kind of interesting that I find it interesting that in the absence of Bruce Rauner and the money and loyalty that he demanded during his tenure, in that absence, the state Republican Party has just gone, you know, all full Donald Trump, as well as all full bore on socially conservative principles. And that appears to be the hill that they're going to mount whatever they can in as we go into this presidential year.
Rick, I want to stay on with you on another topic involving Governor Pritzker making news this week, and this had to do with a plant located in DuPage County. It's called Sterigenics. It's been in the news a lot over the last couple of years, basically because it was found to be emitting a cancer-causing chemical, pretty large amounts of that. There have been lawsuits, things going on behind the scenes on this. What happened this week, and what role is Governor Pritzker playing in this?
Well, one thing to keep in mind, too, this is in Willowbrook, Illinois. It's basically in the backyard of House Republican leader Jim Durkin. And during the legislative session, concerns about the emissions from this plant of ethylene oxide, a cancer-causing agent from this plant, had very much kind of caught the attention of folks in the suburban area. Durkin was able to advance legislation to try to tighten controls. There was questionable US EPA emission studies, all of that. We passed the legislation, the governor signs it. It's presumed that that legislation basically amounted to the death knell of Sterigenics. And then earlier this week, there's a consent decree reached with Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, the DuPage County State's attorney, and the company that basically paves the way for them to reopen, provided that they purchase new equipment to try to contain those potentially deadly emissions.
And not everybody's happy about some of that, but it sounds like you know, that seems like a solution to some of the problem that had been there. What's the concerns?
Well, some of the problems are is one, not a lot of people knew that there was going to be the consent decree, so it caught a lot of the local residents by surprise. Two is the fact that Governor Pritzker issued a statement basically saying he signed the legislation that was Jim Durkin's, but if basically contending that there were potential flaws in the legislation and saying to Durkin, well, if you want to come back with a new bill, I'll call a special session to do it. So all of a sudden now we've got a finger-pointing blame game going on. I remember back when Pritzker signed the Sterigenics legislation, I thought it was very interesting. He didn't go out to DuPage County to sign the legislation. It was just done in his office, and that left the Republican leaders out there to have their own kind of ceremony to honor that this legislation was approved. And it seemed to me, for Pritzker, that would be kind of a no-brainer kind of thing to go out to DuPage County. And yes, it's not as Republicans used to be, but as you're a new governor, you try to broaden your base or whatever, to go out there and sign it. Now, in retrospect, I'm kind of wondering if he didn't know something about potential flaws in this legislation from the very get-go when he signed it.
And Brian, this has been an issue for a while, this idea of a special session, though it seems like that might be a step that I don't know if everybody wants to take. Is this just posturing at this point?
Well, yeah, as we go to air midday Friday, there is a lot of posturing going on. And I thought a pretty extraordinary press release from the governor's office on Thursday evening taking pot shots at Republican leader Durkin, saying, you know, if you want a special session to deal with the legislation that you sponsored earlier this year, well, then I will do that. You know, sort of daring each other almost to, you know, which one is going to blink first here. And you know, Governor Pritzker has taken pains to try and appear bipartisan when he can. And so I think that the sort of anger that you personal twisting of the knife in this statement, this public statement, speaks to the perceived political risks on all sides here. This is something where, you know, these are it's a politically active area. It's a fairly wealthy area. And while, you know, it would be nice to think that the state takes the concerns of all its citizens as seriously when it comes to pollutants and cancer risks from industry, this one seems to have seized the attention in a way that a lot of other ones haven't. And I think that's probably because it is in a fairly wealthy suburban area. Also, frankly, a white suburban area. So, I mean, you know, there are other types of plants in Chicago where there have been coal ash heaps and concerns about air quality in much more lower income black and brown neighborhoods. You don't hear that making the news nearly as much. But because of where this is, because of the heat that's coming down, I think that there is a lot of perceived political risk here.
All right, we'll keep following that. Let me turn to something else making news this week and trying to get a handle on exactly what is going on here. Rick, we'll start with you on it. Are federal agents, are they circling a bit closer to Michael Madigan at this point? There has been some raids taking place on people who have been aligned with the speaker in the past, raids on their personal residences, things of that nature. What's taking place?
I wish I knew. I mean, it certainly looks like the feds are kind of closing in on the veteran House Speaker and Democratic Party chairman. We learned at the Tribune this past week that Mike McLean, a former state legislator from Quincy, long time, close, valued confidant to House Speaker Michael Madigan. We learned that the federal government raided his home in Quincy back in May. We also had previously learned about Alderman Mike Zalewski, former Alderman Mike Zalewski in Chicago, him getting raided, as well as former top aide Kevin Quinn facing raids. We've also found out that somehow, at least in some way, there's an issue involving Commonwealth Edison and the fact that they received subpoenas, and McLean was a heavy hitter lobbyist for decades, and among his clients was Commonwealth Edison. you know, it's hard to kind of put together some of the dots here because there seems to be some disconnect, and the only unifying thing is the fact that these are people that are all very close to the House Speaker.
And as Rick said, he's not sure exactly what's going on, but Charlie, it doesn't look good, at least on the outside.
No, it doesn't, but I would make the observation that for decades, people have tried to bring down Michael Madigan without any success, and I've concluded that whatever you may think of the appearances or propriety of what Madigan has done or is doing, he's been very careful not to do anything that could be that could subject him to criminal prosecution. He gets complaints about how he runs the party. He gets complaints about how he runs the General Assembly or the House, and he gets complaints about his property tax work. But so far, nobody's ever been able to find anything where he stepped over the line and did something criminal. Now, this may be a case. If there's anything there, this may turn it up. But I wouldn't bet money on it.
And, Brian, the same. You feel the same way, that that's a little too early to write that obituary at this point politically?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen similar. I mean, this was before my time. You guys could speak to it better than I could. But in the 90s, there were, you know, concerns about using government employees for political operations in the House. Both the Democrats and the Republicans were looked at, and it was turned out to be a top Republican staffer who ended up getting in trouble for that, and the Democrats did not. And so it was always sort of, even when I was still learning about Illinois government in university, it was, you know, Madigan is always very careful, as Charlie said, to he might walk right up to the line, but he knows where the line is. He probably wrote the law that set the line, and so he is very careful about it. But I think that, you know, it is tempting to speculate about this because there have been not only these raids on him, but people who are in his line of work, Chicago or Alderman Ed Burke, who is also a property tax appeal lawyer and has had the feds come down on him and accuse him of corruption this year. That is Mike Madigan's exact line of work. But again, we have no evidence that Madigan was nearly as allegedly brazen in attempting to solicit business as Alderman Burke is accused of doing. And everything I've ever heard about how the speaker operates, even at his own fundraisers, you know, I've heard that he stands at the door, you walk up, maybe you shake his hand, and that's about it. He's not there to chat and you know, get favors asked of him. He is sort of ensconced in his office deep in the Capitol. He's rarely even on the floor of the House, doing whatever it is he does back there, planning legislation and planning politics, and that's that. But, you know, it's certainly tempting to wonder about what all is going on here.
And we'll continue to watch that one as well. Also, this week, we heard from the Chicago mayor, Lori Lightfoot, on some potential sites for a Chicago casino. We've been waiting to kind of get an idea where this casino, this massive gambling operation, will go. Rick, she offered up five potential sites. Is that right?
Right. Four on the south side and one on the west side. One of the things she had always talked about is the idea of going beyond the prosperous downtown area and trying to help neighborhood development. One of the other things as well is trying to tap into those Illinois residents that routinely cross the border and go to the casinos in Indiana. So that's not surprising to see some of the sites she touted. The question is, and these were sites that were provided as part of a required kind of feasibility study that's required under the law that allows Chicago to get a casino. It's curious to see, you know, we didn't get downtown, we didn't get anywhere near McCormick Place was not included on this list, the convention center. One of the things, I talked to friends that are involved with McCormick Place, they really don't want the casino anywhere near McCormick Place because the people that hold conventions want people to go to the conventions, not to sneak off and go to the casino. But that having been said, you know, when you have a firm doing a feasibility study, it seems, and Lightfoot kind of later acknowledged that these aren't the only sites that, you know, a downtown site could be considered. it would seem to me, you know, if you're going to be a company developing a casino, you want to go to the place where you're going to maximize revenues. And so it'll be kind of interesting to see how these sites score versus, you know, what could very well be a downtown site as well.
And Charlie, you brought that up before too, that maximizing revenue is something that needs to be considered.
Yeah, but I think from listening to the mayor and reading what she said, part of her idea is that this will be an economic development tool, not just for money, but we'll put it somewhere where it will be, I think I thought referred to as it'll be an island where there'll be a casino, but there'll be a hotel, there'll be stores, there'll be restaurants, and it'll be like a whole community built up around the casino that would provide jobs and economic opportunity to the folks who live in those areas. And if you take that into account, then, yeah, the notion of putting it downtown, there's really no dearth of employment opportunities in the Loop, or there's no blighted areas in downtown Chicago. So we'll have to wait and see what the study says, but I think it's important to note that the mayor has not ruled out anything, and it's sort of like, well, we're going to look at these five sites, but maybe we'll go somewhere else.
Also, we're just months away still from the start of the primary or the actual primary elections in Illinois, but we're already seeing some races shaping up for Congress, especially in the suburbs in a couple of key races where the seats flipped in the last election. And Brian, this week we actually heard from the former state representative Jeannie Ives. She's planning to run and looks like a primary being set up in a district she's trying for.
Yeah, there are a couple of seats. That is one of them that Democrats took from Republicans in the 2018 election, and Republicans are eyeing to get them back. And that one is interesting because it is a sort of rematch, if you will, of the gubernatorial primary we had 2 years ago, although with a proxy. State Representative Jeannie Ives, of course, challenged Governor Bruce Rauner and came within 3 points of defeating him in the Republican primary. And now she looks like one of her most formidable challengers will be the Governor Rauner's Lieutenant Governor, Evelyn Sanguinetti, who also wants to take that seat, which is now occupied by the Democrat Sean Casten. So a sort of rematch, if you will. Jeannie Ives built up a lot of people were surprised by how well she did in that primary for somebody who began when she filed her petition papers with fairly low name recognition. So I think she's hoping to be able to sort of continue that wave into a victory here. But then once you get into whoever wins that primary, once you get into the fall, you run into that same question. Is that district going to, you know, midterms are traditionally better for Republicans in some of those races because Democrats tend to favor more presidential election years. But this time, the unpopularity of Trump among Democrats drove their turnout up. And how does that dynamic play out when Trump is actually himself at the top of the ballot? And so that's going to be something to watch.
Yeah, and Rick, do you think in either of those races there, the other race being, of course, against Lauren Underwood, the freshman congresswoman, that Republicans really stand a chance to flip those?
Oh, I mean, if you make the ballot, you certainly have a chance. I mean, we learned that from the last presidential. And obviously, the best time to take on somebody in Congress is when they're in their freshman year, in their first year. They don't have a lot of seniority or a lot of accomplishments to point to. But I think the Casten one, I think, is very interesting in the fact that not only do you have this dynamic of almost kind of a replay of the gubernatorial primary, but I think it's also in a longer kind of step back look at that 6th congressional district, which is pretty much in the heart of DuPage County and then goes northwest to pick up other suburbs. But, you know, that was Rock Rib Republican territory at one time. And we had the evolution that saw Hillary Clinton actually won that district over Donald Trump, obviously Sean Casten winning in the midterm. And the question I have is, when you look at the kind of polarizing campaign that Jeannie Ives ran, all on social conservative ideas of opposing abortion, opposing gay rights, all of those kinds of ideas. I'm very curious how that plays now in this 6th district in a general election atmosphere. Sanguinetti, too, holds those socially conservative views as well. She was very uncomfortable with Governor Rauner's expansion of abortion rights, for example. I'm very curious how that district has really evolved from what it once was, electing Peter Roskam 6 times until Kasten defeated him, and see if there is that evolution that I talked about, not only of attitudes among the residents there in a general election on social conservative issues, but also kind of just the kind of changing demographics of that district as well.
And just a few seconds here, Brian, so far nobody has stepped forward to announce they're going to challenge the U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. He's up for election next time as well.
Yeah, certainly not. I mean, no marquee names on the Republican side. There are some people with relatively low name recognition. And even on the Democratic side, State Representative Ann Stava Murray had said, I think even before she was sworn into the Illinois House, she's a freshman state representative, that she was going to challenge Dick Durbin. She was having a pretty rough time during the House orientation. She had felt bullied because she was one of the few Democrats who was talking about not voting to reelect Representative Madigan as Speaker Madigan. But ultimately, she seems to have found a little bit more comfort level in the House during the spring and is no longer planning to challenge Dick Durbin for the Democratic primary for the Senate nomination.
Okay, let's go to our notes from the field. Charlie, let's go ahead and start with you.
Well, the second piece of legislation that Governor Pritzker signed after taking office imposed new state requirements on federally licensed gun dealers. They would have to get a state license. Well, this past week, the Illinois State Rifle Association, along with several gun dealers, filed a lawsuit here in Sangamon County to block that law. They contend that it's onerous, it would put small dealers out of business, and it would violate the Second Amendment rights of people who would want to purchase these weapons. So we'll see how that plays out.
And Brian.
Yeah, interesting news this week. The Reverend Jesse Jackson and his son, former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., who himself, of course, was convicted of corruption, federal corruption charges, sent a letter urging President Donald Trump to pardon former Governor Rod Blagojevich. So this is yet another attempt of some people to try and get Governor Blagojevich out of prison. People have been making that appeal to President Trump, his lawyers, former governor's wife, Patty Blagojevich, for a long time. We'll see if this one carries any more weight.
All right, that will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Rick Pearson with the Chicago Tribune. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and find us on NPR One. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.